Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then one on your telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to withdraw your question, please press star two. Your first question comes from the line of Steven Winoker from Sanford Bernstein.
Good morning.
Hey, Steven.
Hey, just first question around the order rates for 2011. Can you give us some perspective, sorry, in this quarter, the conversion rate into next year based on what you're seeing now? How much of that converts?
You know, I think if you look historically, somewhere between 85-90% of sort of the orders you bring into the backlog at the end of the year would convert into sales in the next year. So if you end the year, you know, if we end the year, for example, in energy with $13 billion of backlog, you know, you're probably going to get 90% of that converting into sales on average.
And that's true for the current aviation profile?
Aviation's a little longer backlog. You know, if you think about that, I'd use run rates in aviation more than a backlog conversion because, you know, if you look, the airframers are pretty much full, right? They're increasing their rates a bit. You look at the announcements between now and 2012, they're going to have a significant increase in their production rates, but I'd work off of run rates there. You know, the 777 is going to go from 5 to 7 a month by 12. The 737 is going to go from 31 to 38 a month by 13. The A320 is going from 34 to 40 a month by 12. So that's the thing I'd look at is the airframe run rates for aviation.
Okay. I think beyond that, Keith, on aviation is you just have, the Boeing forecast on 787s
got a lot of
juice, yeah. You know, there, given our penetration.
Yeah.
Okay, and am I correct in if I exclude the Iraqi order or at least normalize it from Q2, equipment at the time, instead of being up 17%, was probably up mid-single digit. So this 9% increase, I should sort of think about relative to kind of a mid-single digit increase in the last quarter. If I normalize for that, is that not right?
Yeah, third quarter year to date, equipment orders are up 4%. I think the longer period you take for the long cycle orders give you a better feel for kind of the run rate.
Okay. I mean, Stephen, the way I would look at it, I divide energy more or less into 4 buckets. You know, you've got the service business where orders are picking up and are going to stay, you know, really very strong. And then you've got oil and gas where Keith really talked about some of the transitions in oil and gas, but they're probably flattish to down slightly so far, but there's no reason to expect, you know, oil and gas not to be decent as we go forward. The what I would call the, you know, the fossil fleet in total, which is heavy-duty gas turbines, Yenbacher, aeroderivatives, all that stuff, you know, those are flattish, you know, and I think we'll probably stay in that range. And then, you know, renewables we expect to be down slightly as you go. They were down in, you know, year-to-date and we'll probably continue to be under pressure as we go forward. So I kind of think about it in those 4 buckets.
Okay, all right. And then on just on checks a little bit, the E&I I saw was just up a little bit in the supplemental on the quarter versus the last, 49 versus 47. Is that trending? Anything we should note about the trend relative to your targets on the reducing the size of capital?
No, I think if you look at page 3 of the presentation, we show you that the business reductions in the quarter were strong again. The business reductions were down $9 billion, but with the dollar in the mark from the second quarter to the third quarter, that increased assets by $11 billion. So, you know, in terms of our business reductions, we're still ahead of schedule, and, you know, we're well on track to hit the 440. You know, one of the things that we did in the quarter, as you saw, we also purchased some assets from Citigroup. I mean, it's a, you know, another indication that we're ahead of our shrinkage targets and we have room for some bulk origination as well as the good underwriting and the origination that we're seeing from the commercial teams.
Okay. And then on Shinsei, just a little bit more clarity, the 11% assumed claims per month reduction, that was sort of the run rate that we had in from you guys before. So what number are you thinking of now when you're based on the additional reserving?
Yeah, basically, you know, when you look at the last 12 months of claims activity and you include September, where September went up and we're, as we said, we're, you know, obviously the Takafuji event had some impact on it, but I don't know how much. If you look at the rates, 3 month, 6 month, 9 month, and 12 month reductions in claims per month, they range from 2 to 6%. And so we basically have taken the midpoint of the range, which is the 12-month reduction of an average of about 4%, Steve.
Okay. Okay, well, I have more, but let me hand it off to some other people who can get questions in. Thanks.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of John Inch from Bank of America.
Oh, thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, John.
Good morning, guys. Hey, so what was the organic growth for the industrial businesses, Keith or Jeff, this quarter?
Yeah, organic. Grab that for you. If you look, for industrial, total was down 4.
Mm-hmm.
Energy was down 12. Tech was flat. And H&BS was up 1.
Okay, great. There was no corporate restructuring, and I think, and I can't remember if you sort of had intimated this officially or just it was suggested, that I think you did about 3 cents in the first half, and I had thought the second half was actually going to be a sort of an overall ramp from the 3-cent rate. Does that imply, and I think it kind of goes back to Jeff's comments, does that imply there's a potentially fairly large restructuring action coming in the fourth quarter, maybe offset with DAC sale gains and possibly NBC or some other stuff? Or how should we think about that? What really would be the nature of it? Is it sort of a cleanup heading into 2011, or is it catching up with other things, or how would you like us to think about it?
Well, I think, as Jeff said, you know, in the fourth quarter, we have a number of items that are potentially going to happen. You know, we're expecting the NBC deal to close. If the NBC deal closes in the fourth quarter, that should result in a small after-tax gain. You know, we do expect some tax settlements we're working on right now on years 2003 to 2005 with the IRS, and we're in final discussions. You know, will it happen, and what will the amount be is hard to say, but that could be in there. So offsetting those things are a variety of opportunities, whether it's asset sales or it's continued restructuring like you've seen us do in terms of taking the cost structure down or other charges like the environmental that Jeff said. I mean, I think our anticipation is that, you know, that the negatives will likely be more than offset by some of the positives that we have in the quarter. We don't know. At the end of the day, when you do year over year, I think is the way to look at it, John.
Mm-hmm.
We had a net last year in the quarter of about 6 cents of gains that we had and 9 cents of negatives. If you look at last year's fourth quarter, for a net of 3 cents of restructuring in the quarter. And our view is that right now the restructuring in the fourth quarter and other charges will probably be a little higher than that.
Okay,
you know, John, we can't really time these things, but they're
right,
you know, a lot of them are
events.
Under discussion. I think we always anticipated that some of them would be back and loaded, and that's where we are.
But
again, I think all of them, yeah, in many ways, you know, take risk out of, let's say, 2011.
Oh, it sounds like you're just being opportunistic. You're not. There's not some big, you know, thing you're working toward. That makes sense. Just lastly, you know, the market's kind of been antsy toward the banks possibly having to repurchase bad mortgages. I just, you know, kind of thinking out loud, are there any implications as it pertains to your previous ownership of WMC? I know you got to go back, but I glance at the K and it says that you do actually retain some sort of obligation for liabilities or loans previously sold. So how should we think about that?
Well, you know, we obviously are watching that. You know, I'd say that we've had a very good experience in 2010 and 2009. You know, when we first exited WMC, that's when we had our wave of negotiations and settlements with the banks around mortgages that the team had underwritten and sold. So, you know, at the end of 2009, we had a reserve of about $200 million. The current reserve is about half of that, but we had pending claims in 2009 of close to $800 million. And the pending claims are down over around $250 million. We've had very favorable settlement rates on the claims, and the claims per month have come down in 2010 versus the 2009 levels. So I think our team is on top of it. I think we've dealt with most of what we had to deal with. You know, as far as we know, we've dealt with everything we had to deal with back when we first exited WMC, and we had a big reserve and we had a lot of settlements. But, you know, that activity has really declined substantially. So, you know, as far as our view of this right now is that we're in pretty good shape here on WMC.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Your next question comes from the line of Shannon O'Callaghan from Nomura.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hey, Shannon.
First question on your comfort zone around non-earnings coverage. I mean, it's continued to tick up here. Now we're at 74%. I mean, you know, in the back you show where you think you are versus commercial and consumer at, like, you know, 260 for commercial, 298 for consumer. I mean, where does this 74% go? I mean, obviously non-earning dollars are down. You expect losses to be better than non-earnings. I mean, where does that 74% go from here?
Well, it's going to depend upon, you know, how we do in terms of working out the collateral positions we have. But I feel great about our non-earning coverage. You know, if you look at the data that we've had where we put up a certain amount of reserves and we had a certain amount of non-earnings, like if you go back to the third quarter or fourth quarter of 2009 and you look at the amount of non-earnings in the reserves, we basically worked through the majority of those non-earnings by the end of third quarter. And then, you know, as we have additional new non-earnings, we're continuing to work through, and we work through them in a way that's generally favorable versus our reserve position. So we feel strongly about our collateral coverage. And, you know, that's one thing that we're going to have Jeff Bornstein give a bigger update on when we get to the December meeting, go through. You know, we have some charts we did in July last year where we went through the details of non-earning provisions that we had and then what actually happened. We're going to update those in December and go through them with you, but we feel pretty good about it.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like, you know, you're selling things for greater than your carrying value and things like that, and you've got this big, you know, I'm just wondering when that 74%, you know, goes down.
Really, the driver is going to be how you think about new provisions on losses relative to the quality of the book. And as delinquencies and non-earnings continue to improve, as you say, you know, those additional provisions quarter to quarter are going to continue to come down, and that's going to be really what drives the future profitability here.
Okay. Just on the industrial side, just a question about the, you know, improvements you're talking about in the aerospace aftermarket. I mean, on the last call you said, you know, airlines were still deferring overhauls and things. I mean, what are you seeing in terms of change of behavior on that front?
You know, we're seeing quite a bit of activity in the marketplace, obviously. If you look, you know, revenue passenger miles are up 6.4% August year-to-date. Cargo's up almost 20% August year-to-date. The park fleet has started to change a little bit. You know, we had about 13% of the world's fleet was parked in the first half of the year. It's down to 12%. We've seen a number of cargo planes come out of the park fleet, and we saw the orders picking up if you look at spares relative to last year ex the Avial. So, you know, I think it, you know, looks pretty good. We feel pretty good about the outlook, you know.
Okay. The last one, then I'll go. Just on sort of Basel III requirements and an update there on your thoughts. Sounds like you're pretty comfortable, but just in terms of, you know, where you are, risk-weighted asset treatment and things like that, any color?
Well, it's a lot to still be determined. You know, I think, first of all, most of our entities aren't subject directly to the Basel standard, so, you know, I think we're going to have to still work through how much and what is going to be impacted by Basel III. We've looked at the main published criteria for capital levels and for liquidity. And, you know, if you look, 7% Tier 1 capital requirement, Tier 1 common capital requirement by 2019, I know everyone's going to get to these requirements much sooner than that. And you look at where we are today, even with adjustments we think we may have to make to the risk-weighted asset measurement or what's accounted for as Tier 1 common capital, you know, we feel pretty good that by the end of this year, we're going to be in the ranges here that we need to be in. So there's still more details to be worked out. But obviously, as we shrink GE capital and we continue to, you know, leave that capital in through 2010 and through 2011, we continue to strengthen the capital ratios that we think will be in good shape. You know, we don't have any of the big adjustments that some of the banks have on risk-weighted assets for a couple of things, like we don't have a lot of subordinated capital. We don't have any mortgage servicing rights. We don't have some of the biggest things that are creating some of the adjustments out there, and I think that bodes well for us as we go forward. And then on the liquidity measurements, we feel great about that, obviously, with, you know, the amount of cash that we have and the bringing down the CP balances. You know, we feel like the outlook for that is pretty good shape as well.
Great. Really helpful. Thanks a lot.
Your next question comes from the line of Deane Dray from Citi.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hey, Dean.
Hey, Dean.
Start with a two-part question on M&A, and would like you to put the announcements last week in context, if you could, especially in the acquisition of the consumer finance portfolio. Would that suggest, you know, are you seeing the bottom of the cycle there? You're not just shrinking that book, but you're also selectively looking to grow. That's the first part of the question. And secondly, as you do look at allocation of capital, and by our assessment, this would potentially be the biggest M&A cycle for GE, are you changing any of the processes of how you're vetting acquisition candidates, and you know, what's the environment look like today?
You know, I would say just first on the consumer finance, and I'd like Jeff to comment on overall on the M&A. You know, I think if you look at what we were able to do, we were able to add to a space where we've got a real competitive advantage on distribution. I mean, we're basically a unique provider of capital to retail distribution in this country, and we have a tremendous franchise that our Mark Begor, Glenn Marino run, and they are performing extremely well in the current cycle in terms of their asset quality metrics. And you saw the income in the consumer business and the U.S. retail business. You know, a lot of that is in this retail distribution. So what we acquired were additional retail distribution arrangements. It's more like a B2B financing, and it wasn't in the private label credit card, which is also doing extremely well. So I feel great about that. I mean, adding to that is a place where we've got a nice competitive advantage on distribution. We've got a tremendous business franchise, and we bought assets at a very attractive price.
So I think, Dean, on the other part of your question, I'd first say, you know, our teams are doing a great job on cash generation. You know, I think everybody's really focused on it. You know, be with the incremental capital that we have from the NBCU transaction when that takes place, that really gives us some real tailwind there. The third thing I'd say, just to reiterate what Keith said earlier, is that, you know, we think GE Capital is going to create its own strength, and that's well underway. And so I think GE Capital is in great shape. So we started the buyback. We've increased the dividend, and you know, in the strategic and industrial M&A, I think some of the things that we talked about at EPG, you know, on the size of deal, you know, we'll be disciplined on the size of deal. These will all be infrastructure. You know, all the deals we do will be infrastructure, you know, kind of deals. They'll be bolt-ons to the core of what we're doing, you know, in terms of inside the business. And we think that, you know, as we do these kinds of deals, that they will be able to accrete, you know, in a relatively short time period from a standpoint of what we'll pay and how we value them. You know, they all return greater than our cost of capital. So, you know, just the things that I've talked about in the past, I would say, you know, kind of what you saw last week is, you know, what we'll continue to try to do.
I know you're limited in what you can say about Wellstream, but should the takeaway be that there are valuations of which considers this too expensive? And will you, if you can't spend all this capital, should we infer that there would be more buybacks potentially and higher dividends?
Well, you know what, I would say I can't say anything about Wellstream, period. The second thing I'd say is that, you know, there are good opportunities out there, we think. And the third thing I'd say is that if we don't see good opportunities, we'll increase the dividend and do more buyback.
Perfect.
You know?
Thank you.
So I think that's just, you know, consistent with what we've said in the past.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Christopher Glynn from Oppenheimer.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Just a question on the GE capital operating cost structure. Do you think you need to do some more dramatic downsizing there for the trend to smaller, more focused GE Capital?
I think it'll be pruning. I think we've done a dramatic restructuring. If you look at the change in the cost structure and how much we've taken out of the SG&A of that business over the last 18 months, you know, today we're going to continue to shrink the things that we're running off. The global mortgages will continue to shrink, but we've really cut the cost base dramatically. You know, today we're looking at some things in investment around the mid-market and distribution and in areas where we may be able to take advantage of some of the disruptions because of the capital requirements of the banks or other things where we provide a real competitive advantage. We get local. We're totally connected to the mid-market customer. We're underwriting their assets. We're willing to take the residual risk, because we know the assets and we've got a pretty good value proposition. So I don't think there's going to be a dramatic change in the cost structure there. I think we're going to continue to run off the places that we've set our red assets. You see us doing that. And we're going to incrementally add in places where we think we have a competitive advantage.
Okay, and then the cash balance at GE Capital. How should we think about when that, you know, can start to trend back in the direction towards historical levels?
Well, the way I think about it is it's significant today. It's high today as we brought the CP down. As we continue to maintain the bank lines, you know, that basically is allowing us to continue to pre-fund in advance of maturities. And I think what we're going to do is work our way through 2011, and then obviously we have the TLGP maturities in 2011 and in 2012. And when we get through into what I would call a normalized period, Christopher, we're going to definitely be able to bring the cash balance down, we're going to bring the CP down, and we'll probably operate with less bank lines as we go into that environment. But in terms of ratios and safe and secure, you know, we're going to be able to keep our cash plus our bank lines at 2x our CP. And I think until you work your way through to a normalized period, which we should work through in 12, we're probably going to have the $60 billion kind of range cash, $50 to $60 billion, as we work our way through that. But I think after that period in a normalized place, you're going to be able to bring that down to a lower level and still be above whatever the standards are for the important liquidity measurements for the regulators.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Your next question comes from the line of Steve Tusa from J.P. Morgan.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, Steve.
Good
morning, Steve.
Just wanted to touch on energy for a second. So wind was obviously pretty bad, but I think you said the thermal deliveries were up nicely, yet you know the revenues were still pretty light. Can you just maybe talk about what else happened in the segment there, and then secondly on the margins, you know, pretty good margins on the revenue performance, yet your value gap closed relative to last quarter. So is there something in the mix there that that drove that margin that we should be aware of going forward?
Well, I'd say on revenues, if you look again, the biggest item was renewables. If you look with the wind volume, it was down. Wind turbines were down 300 units. It's down $600 million of revenue in the quarter. Then we had $300 million of balance of plant. You know, when we do a large power plant, a lot of the times we source material and just include it in the project, but it's not GE material. $300 million less. That doesn't have a lot of calories in it, obviously, margin calories for us. So that, you know, that's almost $1 billion of the revenue decline. Those were the biggest factors, I'd say. You know, we had some lower steam turbine units. We had a couple lower generators, but the biggest were those two items. You know, in terms of margins and energy, the team just is doing a tremendous job. You know, they're really working on protecting the price and the backlog. They're doing a great job on sourcing and getting deflation. You know, they're working their way through a wind market that has really collapsed in the U.S., and we've got a very attractive position there. And they're adding value by putting new products in place that give customers a little more value. You know, the 1.6 instead of the 1.5 on the wind turbines and things like that. So they've done a good job working their way through this. I think, you know, services margins have held in all of the infrastructure segments. They've stayed strong. So I don't have one specific mix item. They, you know, with the revenue down and with continuing to provide high margin equipment in the places like the gas turbines and the wind margin that's in backlog is very high. You know, these guys have done a good job combined with the sourcing benefits we're getting.
The other thing I'd say, Steve, is the power gen units are being used right now in the customers' fleets, and that bodes well, I think, for energy services in the rest of this year and into next year.
So you use the term collapsed in the wind market. How is renewables down modestly next year in the face of, you know, what looks to be a pretty horrid environment from an order perspective in wind?
A lot of that's going to come globally, Steve.
Yeah.
You know, like Canada, Brazil, Turkey, places like that. You know, I think are where a lot of the demand is going to be. I'd say probably a lower margins than the U.S. You know, the ones we booked a year or so ago in the U.S. But that's where the demand will be.
Okay, and then just one last question on GE Capital. You know, you talked about holding a $50 to $60 billion of cash. That seems to be significantly higher than kind of the 25 to 40 you guided to last December in that kind of strategic funding plan slide you gave. Is that just driven by, you know, lack of visibility on the new regs? And then secondly, you know, you gave us a nice margin number, a portfolio margin number last quarter. I think it was somewhere in kind of the 5.2 range year to date. Can you maybe just update us on, you know, on whether that's tracking towards that number or what it did in the quarter and how we see that going forward?
Sure. We haven't changed the cash outlook. I guess I'd ask Trevor to look at the chart with you and see what we're dealing with. I think, you know, we've been saying $50 to $60 billion of cash in GE Capital. You know, we just did a bunch of bonds at the end of the quarter that gave us a little bit of cash in advance. I mean, we're gonna look at when the market opportunities are there for us to fund ourselves, and we did like $5 billion right at the end of the quarter. But I think you know, when you looked at the numbers on that, maybe we're dealing with $40 billion in 13, and that's consistent with what I just said. I'd say.
Okay.
In terms of margins, I think the quarter was about 5.1 in the margins, okay. So it's pretty similar to what we had in the second quarter.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Steve.
Your next question comes from the line of Scott Davis from Morgan Stanley.
Good morning.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, Scott. I want to follow up on Steve's question a bit, because I think from the phone calls I'm getting in, the biggest kind of angst out there is coming from the revenue decline in energy infrastructure. How much, I guess kind of my question is were you guys as surprised as we were at how bad things got in wind this fast, or was this something that, you know, we just kind of modeled out wrong and missed the rate of change?
We've been talking about the wind market for quite a while here, and we weren't surprised by it at all. So, you know, maybe we got to look at how do we model it with you guys a little better, but you know, really, it's something that's consistent with what John Kornicki and the team have basically been saying to us all along, and the way we've been planning to run the business.
Fair enough. So let's dig into that a little bit. I mean, if you think in terms of wind revenues down 32%, can you make money in the business at that kind of level? Do we have a much bigger swing in profits? I mean, I know you outsource a lot of components here, and so can moderate production down pretty fast, but how do we think about kind of decremental margins?
Yeah, I think wind can stay very profitable for us. It's an attractive business. You know, we don't disclose the specific profit numbers, but I would say that in relative to our equipment margins, it's a very profitable business. And you know, as Jeff said, we'll probably have a mix shift as we go from some of the backlog stuff that we have in the U.S. We work through that in 9 a little bit. We work through it in 10. We have some more of that in 11. And we're going to shift into international and probably will be slightly lower margins. But it's at a very good profitability level. We're building our service business as we've built out a huge install base, and that's going to, over time, contribute. So, you know, we like the business. We're investing like crazy. We got a big investment in larger wind turbines. We got a great position that we're working on for offshore.
Scott, if I could just take you back to the mosaic that we talked about in May, and then again in the second quarter, we always flagged renewables as a risk, and I think that's well recorded and well written about, not just with GE but others.
Sure.
And then we always said that, you know, on the other side, you know, the way the industry typically works is you get pretty good orders for the aeroderivatives and the gas units like Jenbacher. I think
you've
that's,
seen that really
that's,
pick up.
That's taken place. And then that leads to a rebound in the heavy-duty gas turbine market. That's going to take place. We see pretty good demand outside the U.S. That's taking place. And our service business is dramatically strengthening. You know, so I think when you think about 11 and 12, we think the diversity of this business, you know, is just quite strong. And then, you know, what Keith said earlier is we remain de-verticalized, so we can keep pretty good margins in something like wind, even when the volume, because we've been, you know, we've seen this rodeo before, you know, in terms of how the industry can kind of go through these peaks and valleys. So, I think the revenue number I get, but I think if you look at the margin number and the diversity of the energy portfolio, we feel pretty good about how this business is positioned you know, to fight through, you know, the next few years.
Makes sense. So let's move to something more positive, and that's Dresser. I mean, clearly the market liked that deal, and it's a type of acquisition I don't think we've seen in a while with you guys, and so it's great to see you kind of get back to your roots again. But what when you think about size wise, I mean that was $3 billion, which is about, well, if you're talking about $30 billion over 3 years, I mean should we expect somewhere? Are there more deals in that kind of size range that can move the needle, or was that a bit of a one off? And you know, now you're probably looking at more, like you call them bolt-ons, but Dress is pretty big too.
You know, Scott, we like energy. We think we got a good executing team there, and in the 1 to 3 range, you know, really, if you think about energy and oil and gas, there's just lots of companies in that range. So I think we have a pretty repeatable process in terms of how to get cost synergy. We don't really count on revenue synergies when we evaluate the deals. We like the supply chain. We know how to get cash out of the supply chain. So I think that those are all the positives. And so we think in an orderly way we can kind of chunk through and do a bunch of deals kind of in that range.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Terry Darling from Goldman Sachs.
Hey, thanks. Terry. Good morning. Good
morning, Terry.
Just a couple of cleanup items, I think, on some of the things you mentioned, just some clarifications. I guess first, Jeff, you made a number of comments on 4Q orders, and I'm just trying to wrap all that up, and it kind of sounded to me net-net that orders would be up sequentially but probably down year-over-year given the tough comp in some of the businesses you had last year. Is that the right way to translate?
You know, I think orders will be flattish, Terry, would be my assessment. You know, but again, I hate to give guidance point to point, but I'd say we talked about orders should be flattish, revenue in Q4 industrially should be flat, up Q over Q and flat versus year ago. That's how I'd look at it.
And then just on that orders, you were just talking equipment, right?
Well, equipment and service.
I'm sorry, I was just talking equipment then.
I think equipment will be maybe up slightly, flat to up slightly in
okay.
that range.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I'm just wondering, is there any update on in some of the key commercial aero headwinds on R&D and startup losses that we talked about last quarter, or are those numbers still roughly as you thought they were a quarter ago? In terms
sorry,
of the
try the question again, Terry. I'm sorry.
So, talking about some of the 2011 headwinds in commercial aviation. The R&D increase that we talked about last quarter, as well as the startup losses on GENX, have any of those numbers moved around on us at all here?
There's a little bit that's going to happen in 10 versus what we'd planned, but there's still going to be a chunk in 11 as well.
And that's still kind of 500, 700, if I'm remembering correctly, or
we left it
or
at 500 about.
Yeah,
about
we left 500,
and we said that's completely consistent with what we've.
It's no worse than that.
Yeah.
Great. No change there. And then any update on pension headwind for next year? You know, you did mention that. I think we all can see what's happening with rates, but any finer point you want to put on that for people?
Well, I think if you look at pension for us, this year we're experiencing about a $1 billion pre-tax headwind. Without any other changes, that would be a similar amount next year. Today, there's two unknowns, really, right? There's the discount rate, and then there's the what do you do with your earnings rate. Those are the two things being debated a lot in the world. I'd say from a discount rate perspective today, if you had to do it, it's somewhere between around 70 basis points probably lower. But, who knows what the 10-year is going to do and what the 10-year AA is going to do between now and year-end. So there's variability there. We said that 25 basis points of discount rate is about $200 million of increased pension costs. And then, what's your return on assets? You know, we have an 8.5% assumption. Over a long period of time, we've more than made that. In the short period with the 2008 losses, you don't get that in the 5- and 10-year averages. But excluding that, the returns have been very good. We've got a very high equity allocation. We've got a long-term liability we're dealing with here. You know, we're 7% through roughly today, through the third quarter, up in the pension in terms of the return. So, how will that play out? We'll have to see. We've said that a 50 basis point change there is somewhere around $300 million. So those size kind of the dimension of what we may be dealing with, and we'll have to give that update in December when we get to there.
That's helpful. Just a couple other quick ones. First, Keith, on tax. I think maybe I missed it. Apologize, but the lower rate this quarter than I think you had been looking for. What was the driver there? And then it sounds like fourth quarter is closer to 20%, maybe to get the full year to the mid-20s. And then any counsel on 11 at this early stage?
Well, first of all, the tax rate's exactly what we were expecting in the third quarter. I mean, if you look at it, it's flat to last year. In terms of rate, it's $50 million higher of a provision for the industrial. It's I don't know, $750 million higher of a provision in GE Capital. So, taxes are $800 million higher year over year and flat from a rate on the industrial and significantly higher, obviously, on the capital side in terms of dollars. For the year, excluding the NBCU sale, which will create volatility in the tax rate, we're saying that we estimate the industrial rate, which is 26% year-to-date third quarter, to be somewhere lower than that, and that depends upon whether or not, we do reach a settlement on the 2003 to 2005 tax year. And because we're in negotiations on that, I do not have an amount on that, but the tax rate in the fourth quarter would be lower for industrial to bring the overall rate down a bit.
But, Keith, if we complete NBC,
that raises the tax
that'll
rate.
Raise the tax
that'll
rate.
Raise the tax rate. Because we've got a low basis, there'll be a high tax on that gain. Absolutely. For 11, we'd say that industrial rates are going to stay in the mid-20s. We don't have a change in anything structurally. And then in G Capital, we'll have to see how things go. We would expect the rate to be similar to what we get as a total year rate this year. And we expect the structural benefits between somewhere $1.8 and $2 billion. This year should be similar next year, and we need legislation to get extended to get to those rates.
Okay, and then just one last quick one. Should we anticipate a WMC reserve increase of any meaningful order of magnitude in the fourth quarter?
I don't foresee that at all.
Okay, thanks very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Julian Mitchell from Credit Suisse.
Yes, thanks.
Hey, Julian. Morning, Julian.
Hey. My first question was really on the power side in terms of not so much volumes, but what you're seeing on pricing, because you mentioned it being a sort of high single-digit negative in your order backlog at Q2. Siemens said something similar about a month ago. So I wondered if you'd seen any change in pricing trends very recently, because I guess there's a sense in which the large thermal stuff, in particular gas, is near its volume sort of trough. So if you're seeing pricing starting to firm up there, wind, obviously, you're not near that volume trough, so I guess pricing remains very difficult. And what you think that means for your value gap going forwards?
I think the pricing remains challenged, right? I mean,
yeah, energy overall was down 2.8, Jeff.
Yeah.
Thermal was down 5. Not a lot of orders, yeah. And then obviously wind was down about 12,
yeah.
So renewables. So overall 2.8 because you got a benefit in services. So
and other component, the other
aeroderivatives
and stuff like that is pretty strong. So I think we're still seeing pretty good deflation, in terms of what the teams are doing, in terms of productivity and material cost out and sourcing. So I think. We haven't gone through the budget for next year on value gap and things like that, but this team, does a pretty good job in those areas.
Okay, but is there still a big gap between the pricing effect in your P&L and the pricing effect in your backlog, or is that gap closing already?
I think it's closing, Julian. In other words, I think if you look at I think things aren't getting worse, and I think it's closing. But we'll be able to reflect more when we get together in December.
Sure. Okay. And then secondly, just on the healthcare market, you mentioned, cost-saving initiatives offsetting pricing there. I guess pricing is always a feature in healthcare. Has there been any change there recently? And also, I guess, on the demand side in the U.S., has there been any change in the last sort of 3 or 4 months, or everything is as it was in June?
Julian, I would say that their margin rates are pretty good, and the pricing is, if anything, slightly stronger than they had anticipated, or at least no worse. And so I think they've done a nice job there, and they're building a lot of backlog. I think the U.S. market is, vibrant's the wrong word, but I think people are redoing their
they're planning on post reform, and that's been generally positive. So I think the market itself and our performance is pretty good.
Great, thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Nigel Cole from Deutsche Bank.
Thanks. Good morning, guys.
Hey, Nigel.
So I hate to go back to wind again, but I thought Jeff's comments about the margin in the backlog on wind is very good, and I think he might have said actually improving. Yet pricing down, I think, 8% last quarter, down 12% this quarter. It sounds like you're having a lot of success in passing through that deflation to your supply chain, and I just wondered maybe if you're getting more success in going back and shaking those guys down. Well, maybe that's the wrong word, but certainly a tremendous job at the margins, and just wondered if you could just go into that a bit more.
Well, I think the strategy has been for a long time on all the stuff we do is to be pretty de-verticalized, and I think we do a good job of working with our suppliers on productivity and cost out. You know, all that being said, my suspicion is that the margin in the renewable business will be down year over year, and that'll be offset by improvements in services and oil and gas and some of the other areas.
Okay. And just so I understand your 4Q revenue comments, I think you said flat year over year in 4Q.
On the industrial side.
On the industrial side, but that implies about 20% pickup from 3Q levels. Could you maybe just go into what's driving that pickup? Because it implies a nice reversion in both energy and primarily energy.
Well, I think it's been typical over time is that you've got people finish out the year, and that's when a lot of the projects complete. Healthcare, in particular, there's a budgeting cycle by the hospitals that impacts healthcare. But in some ways, almost every one of our infrastructure businesses has
a pretty
stronger,
consistent quarterly annual power.
Fourth quarter, third quarter. A lot of our customers do shutdowns, and power plants do turnarounds and stuff like that. So this is not atypical, I don't think, Nigel.
Yeah, no, I know the 4Q is usually higher, but the 20% pickup is a lot higher than we usually see. But that's great news. And then Keith, on the NBC gain offset by some items. I mean, we've done some back of the envelope calculations that suggest the gain could be close to $1 billion pre-tax, and it sounds like it's going to be lower than that. Could you maybe just put some color on that?
I haven't done what the pre-tax number is. I think what we said is we'll have a couple hundred million after-tax gain. You know, as I said, it's a high tax transaction, so we're still finalizing so much around that valuation and accounting and tax, but. You know, my expectation today is we'd have a couple hundred million dollar after-tax gain. And does it have some range around it? Sure it does.
Okay. And then just one quick one, then I'll pass it on. The losses have been coming down very nicely in GE Capital, $1.7 billion this quarter.
Yep.
You know, on the E&I target that you have, the $400 billion long-term target, what kind of, what sort of neighborhood of losses would you think is a good run rate on that asset base?
Well, I think if you go back to our pre-crisis levels and you take a look at our average normalized consumer losses and our average normalized commercial losses, and you look at the mix of the business, our traditional loss rates are down around a little over 1%, 1-1.5%, with a good consumer mix. So our expectation is that we go back to pre-crisis loss levels, and then if you adjust for the mix between commercial and consumer, you can get a pretty good number there.
And that suggests something in the range of about $500 million.
That sounds low.
Too low? Okay, great.
You're talking about on a quarterly basis?
Yeah, that'd be quarterly basis.
It still seems a little low to me.
Okay, thanks, Keith.
Our next question comes from the line of Jeff Sprague from Vertical Research Partners.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Jeff. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, could we make sure we've got the aviation R&D thing straight? So you gave a generalized answer to Terry, but my understanding is you're thinking there's a $300 to $500 million R&D headwind next year, but that was allowing for the possibility of a 737 re-engine, which clearly isn't going to happen, and possibly allowing for an A320 re-engine, which is maybe not happening, certainly sliding further to the right. So, as you look at what actually might happen as opposed to what you were conceptually prepared for, what do you think the R&D headwind actually looks like?
You know, Jeff, we haven't done our formal budgets for next year, and there's a lot I'd still like to go through. But, you know, we're shipping the GNX engines in the third quarter and fourth quarter of this year, right? So those are some of the costs associated with that. And, look, it's certainly not going to be any worse next year than what we've already said and could be better. But I'd rather kind of go through that with you as we finish this year, and I think we've made a little bit better through stuff we've done in 10, and then we'll just see where the R&D goes as we go into next year.
Look, that's a big category. The $500 million that has been discussed is not one thing. It's a total set of things, including the launch of the Gen X, including the new programs, including other expenses we have with those programs, including China. So it's a lot of things. I think if you think about it in a macro sense, it's built into our run rates. You're seeing some of it in the run rate in the third and fourth quarter here with what we talked about in aviation, and there are other things in 2011 that offset that. I mean, if you look, we expect to have a good improvement in the services growth. We do have some other volume growth across the other commercial engines that, you know, aren't as pressured when you look at that compared to the Gen X, and we've got pretty good margins in the rest of that business. So it's not one lump sum thing down year over year. It's included in a lot of the run rate. It's just a pressure that does have to be absorbed by the business as we go through a lot of development. And those development programs are multi-year. I mean, we're investing in the LeapX. We're going to continue to invest in the LeapX. So I think it's a part of the fabric of that business, but it's not one lump sum number that's like just down next year because of that. That's never what we intended it to be.
That's helpful. So then just maybe to understand the run rate then, obviously the margins did step down in Q3. Can you give us a sense of what the Gen X impact was in the quarter?
You know, we're not giving out an individual kind of product margin, Jeff. You know, these launch engines are definitely pressured when you look at the concession levels and also the learning curve on the engine, and that will improve as we go through 2010 and go through 2011. We get up to normal volumes and we get to more normal launch prices and concessions. You know, you're going to see that continue to improve, but we're not giving a specific margin per engine on a product line. We haven't traditionally done that. So
you shipped
it's part of the fact that the business was down 17 in the quarter.
Yeah, you shipped physical Gen X engines in the quarter, though, correct?
We recorded a revenue on about 18, and those are for the 747 so far. That engine is certified in the fourth quarter. The engine for the 787 will certify, we believe.
And a lot of ground's been covered here, but just over onto oil and gas. What are the margin ramifications for this transition in the business from downstream to upstream?
Yeah, I think the equipment margin ramifications are not. It's not a change. It was really a volume thing that we were talking about. The LNG margins are at least the average margins for the equipment of this business. They've done a tremendous job on winning the LNG orders around the world. And those will be, we had a little bit of Gorgon in the quarter, actually. So it's not a margin shift issue. It's really a timing of volume issue. And we hope we'll show you that when we look at the fourth quarter and you see the orders again and you look at the total year orders, you know, you're going to feel pretty good about it.
Is there something, you know, that's driving the delay? Is it financing? Is it uncertainty about energy prices? Or is it just noise, you think?
I think we saw, you know, projects push in the quarter across the business for whatever reason, whether it's financing or it's the ability to get the resources they need to do the project. In certain parts of the world, we have some constraints. You know, if you look in Australia, places just packed with orders and opportunities, and they're trying to get the ability to execute. So it's a combination of things. But it doesn't change our outlook at all on the view for oil and gas, that's for sure.
I think it's mainly noise, Jeff. I really do.
Okay, and I'm sorry, just one last one. Did you say aero spares were up some 25%?
If you look, the reported is down too at the 22 million a day, Jeff. But we had this Avial order that we did last year in every quarter that, you know, it was for not the core business production spares where they're going to handle that for us. And that kind of distorts the average daily order rate. If you compare it X that Avial order, it's up about 25%. So at 22 million a day, that's and again, I think part of that is the comparison last year. We really dipped in the third quarter last year as the park planes went in and as people pushed out maintenance. You know, we were down in the $17-18 million a day range. So I part of it's that. But at $22 million a day, that's a really good order rate for us and a very healthy order rate for the business.
Is the AVL comp the same in Q4, and is it totally burned off at that point?
Q4 is the last quarter of it. I don't know the exact number, but it's in the Q4 numbers that I saw. I saw there was some AVL.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thanks, Jeff.
And our last question comes from the line of Bob Cornell from Barclays Capital.
No, let's leave the best for last.
All right, Bob. How are you?
The pre-provision earnings in the capital less than I thought at $2.2 billion versus an estimate of $2.7 billion. But from what you said, it sounds like impairments were over $1 billion because loss and impairments were $2.8 billion. My point is that it looks like the pre-provision earnings, I mean, the net interest margin actually was a positive in the quarters. Could you just take us through that a little bit and tell us what was going on in the impairments, what might happen in the fourth quarter?
Well, first, in terms of pre-tax, pre-provision, I'll go from 2Q to 3Q.
Right.
We were 2.7 in 2Q, 2.2 in 3Q, so it's down about $500 million.
Right.
300 of that is the higher marks and impairments. Now, you got to remember, in the quarter, we had about 200 of that comes from the GCAS annual impairment review, and that was a little high, and that was higher than what we had last year, obviously. We had another 100 in Treasury in marks and impairments that, again, at the end of the day, those hedge marks go to zero when the instrument gets to the end of its life, but that was 100. And then we also had a little bit year-over-year when you, or quarter-over-quarter, when you look, we had a Regency positive in the second quarter. It doesn't repeat. So, I think if you look at it, our view is if you do pre-tax, so you just do pre-tax, that Q2 was 700, Q3 is 500, down 200. It's really all the impairments in GCAS, higher inheritance in GCAS quarter-over-quarter. And even at that level, that's pretty good profitability for JEX since part of this turnaround. I mean, it gives us plenty of pre-tax. We don't believe we're going to have any payment under the income maintenance agreement. And I think the impairments, at the end of the day, those are not run rate types of things. Those are things that we're having to deal with on a quarter-by-quarter basis, and they're not going to be staying at those levels in the run rates forever.
Just, what was the net interest margin, third over second, and was that, is it trending up or trending down?
I don't know what that number is, Bob.
Well, I guess the point is, are you seeing some margin compression in the business?
No, overall we were at 5.2 versus 5.1. So 5.1 versus 5.2 in the second quarter, 5.1. So it's running at about that rate. But I think that the bigger thing is if you look at the new volume we did, and we cover that in here, the amounts and the ROIs. I mean, you're talking about 2.6 ROI on the new volume we did. That's really attractive.
So just to make it clear,
at a very attractive rate.
You had $300 million higher in marks and impairments second quarter, is that what you said?
Yes, I did.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Great, Noelia, I think that's the end of the Q&A. Thank you, everyone. The replay of today's webcast will be available this afternoon. Just a few housekeeping items here, if you can stick with me for a minute. We will be distributing our quarterly supplemental data schedule for GE Capital later today that we started doing last quarter. And I do have several events to announce. First, we'll be hosting our GE Healthcare Analyst Meeting in New York City on November 9th. Please visit our website for details. Second, we will host our GE Capital webcast on December 7th. We'll send out details once that's finalized. Third, our annual Outlook meeting with our chairman and CEO in New York City, which we hold every year, will be held on December 14th. More information will be sent out closer to that date. And then finally, our fourth quarter 2010 earnings webcast will take place on Friday, January 21st. So if you could put those on your calendar and join us, that would be great. As always, Joanne and I will be available to take questions later today. Thank you very much, everyone.